This is One-on-One with Mark Monteith on 1070 The Fan. Brought to you by Georgetown Market, Indy's family-owned natural food store since 1973. Movie Time Video Productions, they make your memories last forever.
He made history and he witnessed history, but he never forgot his roots. A basketball star at Anderson High School, he played for the top-ranked team in the state, one that should have won a state championship. But he made his career in baseball, where he was one of the boys of summer with the Brooklyn Dodgers. He won 122 games, threw two no-hitters, appeared in five World Series, and won a World Series game in 1955 when the Dodgers won the championship. He made the historic move with the Dodgers to Los Angeles, but he had to retire at 32 years old when his arm gave out. He was a close friend of Jackie Robinson's, and saw firsthand what Robinson experienced as the first black player in Major League Baseball. Later, he witnessed someone else's effort to be accepted by society. His son Jimmy was born with Down syndrome and served as another role model. He never left Anderson, living there in the off seasons and after his retirement from baseball, and became a business and community leader there. In fact, earlier this year, he was presented with the Sachem Award, the top honor for a Hoosier. I'm Mark Monteith, and I'm going one-on-one with Carl Erskine. Well, today, one-on-one comes to you with Carl Erskine. We haven't had a chance yet to talk with a baseball personality, and nobody better than Carl Erskine, Anderson native, who gained national fame for the Brooklyn Dodgers in the 1950s and has a great story to tell. Carl, I wanted to start out, though, growing up in Anderson, I know you were as much a basketball player as a baseball player there. As a kid growing up, did you have a favorite sport, or did you like everything kind of equally?
Well, you kind of hit it there, Mark, and I'm happy to speak with you. When somebody used to ask me, what's your favorite sport, I'd say whatever was in season, and that's kind of the way it was growing up. But basketball was king, and Anderson had the Wigwam, which is a famous gymnasium. And so to play basketball, I did through elementary school, junior high, middle school, and on into the varsity in high school. And truthfully, I was better known in Anderson for being a guard on the Anderson Indians and playing with my buddy, lifelong buddy from grade school up, Johnny Wilson, who known more like Jumpin' Johnny Wilson because right. He was such a rebounder and scorer. But baseball, oftentimes, after I was playing a few years in pro baseball, someone would stop me on the street in Anderson and say, boy, Carl, I remember that game, and I would think he's going to relate to some baseball game, and he'd say, that game in Kokomo, that you hit that shot from the corner. Yeah, so you're right. In those days, at least, not so much today. Basketball was the identification. If you had that with the Anderson Indians, you were kind of up there.
What sparked your interest in basketball? Was it simply growing up in Anderson and going to high school games?
Well, when I was about 10 or 11 years old, right in there, Anderson won the state championship in 1937 and 1939. Well, both of those years were my growing up years, and just starting to recognize, and by winning those two state championships almost back-to-back, that made basketball even bigger in our community. And the coach was Archie Chadd, was a famous name. And in those days, the coach at the high school would coach probably three sports. And so when I was a freshman in high school, Mr. Chadd called me into the office, and I was scared stiff why he would even know who I was. But he had known about me playing in the Park Leagues, which was baseball before Little League, and he said, I want you out for baseball. That just shocked me because I didn't know anybody knew I pitched baseball in his kids' league. But he did bring me on the team as a freshman, and I lettered 4 years. But Mr. Chadd was the one who recognized, the first one ever that I know of any stature, that recognized any baseball ability in me. And I was probably 13 years old. So he was right on the money.
It sounds to me like you're kind of just a natural pitcher. Do you feel that way?
I tell a story of my dad, who had a good arm and played semi-pro baseball well before I knew anything about it, because I was the youngest of three boys, and my oldest brother was about 20 years my senior. So I was, my dad was 40, I'll bet, when I was born. But he wasn't playing baseball anymore, but he did have a good arm, and we'd go to county fair, and my dad would never get past a dunk tank. He would stop there and spend his paycheck, I think, throwing three balls to knock this guy in the water. And so they'd kid him. They'd say, oh, you're not back again tonight, are you? Oh, man, here we go, ka-choom. He'd knock a guy down. So I got to throwing with my dad a lot and my brothers, and that's my first recollection of throwing a baseball, would be at the side of the house every day in the evening, summertime, when dad come home from work, we'd play catch. We'd play burnout. Well, I was the youngest, the smallest, and when we burnout is a little game, you start nice and easy, and you lob the ball, and it gets a little harder and a little harder, and then I'd back up, and it'd get a little harder, and finally I'd be up against the old barn, and they got me pinned down, and to throw hard and hardest, I throw straight overhand, and the higher I get, the faster I could throw. Till finally, that's how I learned to throw my fastball straight overhand. There's only a few pitchers in my era, Warren Spahn and later Koufax, who threw directly, I mean straight over the top, and that's the way I learned to pitch.
You mentioned that barn earlier. That's also where you kind of began your basketball career, isn't it, playing on a goal at that barn?
Well, actually, it was another barn, but okay. I had a good buddy besides Johnny Wilson named Jack Rector. He lived about a couple blocks away from me, and he had a goal up on the back of his barn, and that's where we played our basketball games. And it was, of course, unpaved back there in the old alley. There were ruts. You had to dribble through all those ruts. So we learned how to dribble under the toughest conditions, and I think that helped us in playing on a good gym floor.
Sure. That was easy, dribbling on a flat floor after dribbling right on frozen mud.
Well, so, you played in the wintertime, and we'd sweep the snow off or whatever, and these ruts were frozen solid, so it was like dribbling on a corduroy surface. But we had the three of us, Jack Rector, who was my catcher in high school, and Johnny Wilson, who was a great athlete. He was not only a basketball, he was a great track star. And then a baseball. He later played for the Globetrotters, and then also played for the Chicago American Giants in the Negro League. I played first base, and Johnny was an outstanding athlete all the way around.
He was Mr. Basketball in 1946. He was about a six-footer, I think, but a great jumper.
He had to stretch probably to be six. I think he's probably 6 foot tall, yeah. But he was, his timing, the rebounding and scoring has a whole lot to do with timing. So Johnny would out-jump guys that were 6'5", 6'6", who were flat-footed, and on rebounds, he had such tremendous timing that he'd get the tip in or steal the ball.
Right, and Anderson reaches the state finals in 1944, which is, what, your junior year, I believe?
That was junior, right.
Yeah, and you lost to Kokomo in the semifinals.
That was a great team. That team should have won it.
You were ranked number one most of the year.
We were, and Look Magazine get a big spread on us. We were number one and beat everybody in a tournament toward the Final Four. But in the semi-state, we had a lead over a team called Aurora, Indiana. And we had a lead, and Johnny always contends that this was a deliberate thing. Hard to tell, but on a fast break where he was in the middle, had the ball, and a kid undercut him so severely that he fell and hit his back and was so stoved up through the week he couldn't practice. And on the day of the Final Four, we played Kokomo in the afternoon, who we had beaten during the regular season. It was one of those bizarre games when the rest of us, we didn't step up very well. And Wilson was so hurt that he couldn't contribute much. And it ended up Kokomo beating us. And it was just a big disappointment, because I don't think there's any question we had the best team in the state. But, it's the way sports go.
And Anderson would go on to win the state championship in 1946 after you're gone. What was basketball like in Anderson then? This is kind of the glory days of Indiana high school basketball. You're playing in this huge gym, the Wigwam. Anderson's, you know, not a huge community. You know, what did high school basketball mean then to a community like Anderson?
It was the sport, and it was the epitome of an athlete to get to wear and play for the Anderson Indians and play in the Wigwam. That was, I tell you what, when the Dodgers gave me my first uniform, honestly, I don't know that that was any bigger thrill than the time that they handed me my Anderson Indians basketball uniform. Mm. It was the sport, and it was the highest recognition, I think, of a high school player to be to excel. I've won games in baseball. Nobody knew I was playing. We didn't draw anybody in baseball. But in basketball, that gymnasium seated 9,000 close to it. And it was not unusual to see it packed to the rafters. Just the whole town was turned on.
Yeah, when you guys lost in the state tournament your senior year or your junior year in 44, what was the reaction in the community? Were people supportive? Were people mad at you? You know, the way fans can be after a disappointing loss?
Yeah, it was a huge disappointment because we were expected to win. I'll put it in the same category as when the Dodgers got beat in 1951 by Bobby Thompson's home run.
Wow.
In the final game, the disappointment was bitter. It just was hard to take. And for young kids in Anderson, we got too much attention probably as athletes. But you could walk in any store in Anderson, Indiana. If you were a member of the starting five especially, everybody knew you. You could hardly buy anything. They always wanted to give you the item that you went in to buy. Community was saturated, and I think it was overdone, as athletes get a lot of accolades that other professions kind of get shoved aside.
Erskine joins the Dodgers and finds out Brooklyn really isn't that much different than Anderson when One-on-One continues. Welcome back to One-on-One. I'm Mark Monteith, here today with Anderson's own Carl Erskine. You know, one might think a kid from a small Midwestern town would be intimidated by moving to Brooklyn, New York, but Erskine and his wife got over that quickly when he joined the Dodgers after a quick rise through the minors. Turns out Brooklyn was just a big friendly neighborhood where a professional baseball player could get a room at the Y and ride the subway to the games. But then you get to the Dodgers after, as you said, a very brief minor league career and had great success there. You're part of the Boys of Summer, the 1950s Dodgers team out of Brooklyn. Playing in Brooklyn then as a baseball player must have been somewhat like playing basketball in Anderson as a high school kid, the attention and the love the fans there had for you.
Well, the major difference was that in Anderson, by the time I got to the varsity level basketball, we had a great history. We had a history of being winners, state champions, and all that. When I got to Brooklyn, the Brooklyn team had a reputation of second division play. They'd win every now and then. They'd get a team that might win a pennant, but never a World Series. And most of the time, there was a lot of comic stuff about the Dodgers, the bums.
Right.
That they got hit on the head with fly balls, and they ran the wrong way on the bases, and all this bizarre stuff. They were kind of the clown princes of baseball. and all these weird things that happened at Ebbets Field, and umpires were booed substantially, and even one incident where a fan jumped out of the stands and choked George Majorkurth, the senior umpire behind home plate, because of a call he made. They had this crazy reputation and had not been a successful team consistently. So in 1946, when the war was over and guys were coming back, and Pee Wee Reese was the oldest player on our old, considering he was, we were all 19, 20, 21-year-olds at that time, and Pee Wee was more of a senior, and Carl Ferrillo came back from the war. And then Mr. Rickey, who had built the Cardinals system to a success over the years, was now in Brooklyn, and he was a general manager, part owner. And he began to rebuild that team with his concept of a farm system, raising his own talent. And he began to put things together. But the historic piece of that is Jackie Robinson.
Mm-hmm.
When he decided, Mr. Rickey decided to go into the Negro League and find the best player he could find to bring into the major leagues, which had a prohibition against black athletes. There were no black athletes in pro baseball before 1946. And it's unreal, but Mr. Rickey, whatever his motivation was, nobody really knows. He was a smart man, a brilliant man. He saw all this talent in the Negro League. Plus, our Constitution says we're equal in America. And Mr. Rickey, a strong Christian man, said, this is not right, and we're going to make a shot at it. And he had to work hard to convince the owners, but he had an ally in the Commissioner of Baseball. An unusual ally was Happy Chandler, who was from from Kentucky and had been the governor of Kentucky, was now baseball commissioner. And Happy Chandler was a strong advocate for breaking the color barrier. And that helped Mr. Rickey convince enough owners to do it that they agreed. So they finally let Jackie sign a contract. So that was the biggest piece of history in my career.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Jackie coming in. But then he formed this team around Jackie of Gil Hodges and Pee Wee, of course, I mentioned, and Duke Snyder, Carl Ferrillo, Roy Campanella, and the first black pitcher was Don Newcomb. Not the first one, but he's the first one of any significance on the Dodgers. But then I fell into that beautiful timing of me being a skinny kid from Anderson, Indiana, being called up to pitch on this magnificent team. And so that was a huge break for me.
Yeah, and you're living, people should understand, you're living right in Brooklyn. You're part of the community. From what I've read, that, you know, after a game, you might be out playing in the street with the kids, that kind of thing.
It was true. Betty and I, Betty is my high school girlfriend, sweetheart, we married after my first year in pro ball. So when I was called up, Betty and I go to Brooklyn, and I don't think Betty had ever been out of the Madison County. And we were overwhelmed to go to a city of 12 million people. But once we got in the neighborhood, the people were like hometown people. We got to know the barber, of course, would take my kids there, and the grocery, the butcher, just the neighborhood, and babysitters that we'd hire in the neighborhood. It was something like a hometown, a small town in that neighborhood called Bay Ridge in Brooklyn, where we lived. So Betty and I quickly found out that, boy, we were comfortable. And I'd go on a road trip for 2 weeks. I never felt that Betty was threatened or kids had to be really herded in fast. You know, we were just part of the community. And I feel like, in a way, Brooklyn adopted us. And Duke Snyder and his kids were small. All these young players, our families were little. So we all kind of raised our kids together. So it wasn't the experience you could imagine of going to a big city and being overwhelmed.
And they called you Oisk.
Well, when I came up, my first day, I asked somebody how to get to Ebbets Field, and they said, take a subway, and you get off at Flatbush Avenue. So I take my little ride, and I get off and go into the big rotunda at Ebbets Field, and I'm carrying my duffel bag, and it has Fort Worth Cats. That was our team name in Fort Worth. It has Fort Worth Cats on the side. Well, I went into this big rotunda. People were waiting in line for tickets, and of course the Brooklyn fans were sharp. They knew this kid was coming up from the minors, and named Erskine or whatever. But when they pronounced my name in Brooklyn, it was Carl Oyskin. Carl Oyskin. Oysk is here. Oysk is going to save us. Okay, well, I heard that from day one. Oyskin from Fort Worth, and now I'm stamped forever with this unusual name, nickname of Oysk, and they'd yell it from the stands at me, and it just fit the Brooklyn tongue just right.
Mm-hmm.
So to this day, people, even in Anderson, Indiana, occasionally I would be down the street and somebody would yell, "Hey, Oysk, how you doing?"
Did you take the subway to games very often?
Yeah, I did. In those early years, I didn't have any money. Came out of the minor leagues where you practically starve to death, and I didn't have enough money to stay in a hotel. So I'd grown up around the YMCA in Anderson, so I asked somebody, "Is there a YMCA in Brooklyn?" I said, "Yeah." Well, in those days, YMCAs had dormitories, mm-hmm. had living quarters, and they said, "Yeah, the Hanson Place YMCA is the largest Y in the world," and they told me how to get there. I went there on the subway. Checked in, got me a room on the second floor on the corner. I had a cot and a bare desk. That was it. And down the hall was the shower and the restroom and the pay telephone. It was down the hall. So that was where I lived. And I won two games in relief. And I'd go down the hall and call my mom and dad and tell them what happened. And then I got a start against the Cubs. I beat the Cubs, pitched a complete game. I went down the hall and called home. Then I won two more complete games. So I was 5-0 living at the Y. And I often said later when I got established and Betty and I lived in a nice house in Bay Ridge, I'd get in a slump. I'd tell Betty, I think I'll go check in the Y, see if I can get straightened out.
Recapture that magic.
So that's how I started. And I don't tell that to say I was poor. That was just, we didn't make a lot of money. And the first contract in the big leagues was $5,000. Well, I told that to a young player, a current player in spring training last year. He said, what'd you make your first year? And I said, $5,000. He thought I meant per month.
said,
no, that was for the whole season.
Erskine talks about its legendary teammate, Jackie Robinson, when One-on-One continues. Back on One-on-One, I'm Mark Monteith. Today's guest is Anderson native and former Brooklyn Dodgers pitcher Carl Erskine, who witnessed firsthand the experience of Jackie Robinson when he broke baseball's color barrier. Let's let Erskine tell you how it really was. You mentioned Jackie Robinson, and certainly your story is intertwined with his. You mentioned he broke the color barrier, joined the Dodgers. You know, you saw it firsthand. How much resentment or ill treatment did he receive, not only from players on opposing teams, but members of the Dodgers?
Well, it's interesting how history records things. It's not untrue, but it's how much emphasis you put on it. I wasn't there in 47. That was my first year in the minors. So Jackie was a rookie in 47, and that's when a lot of this came into play. There were two players on the Dodgers who I knew quite well, Dixie Walker and Bobby Bregan, both from the Deep South. And when they heard that Jackie was going to be on the team, they said, "We don't do that. That's white players don't play with black players on the same. We can play against them, but we never play with a black player on the same team. So we say no." And Dixie Walker and Bobby Bregan were both major league players. Dixie was the most popular player on the Dodgers. And his nickname was the People's Choice, which meant the people's choice. In Brooklyn, they twisted that a little. But Mr. Rickey said, "Well, if you won't accept this, we'll trade you." And they did trade Walker. Now, Dixie was a Southern boy from Leeds, Alabama. Now, what was he going to say when somebody said to him, are you going to play with this black player? And then he had to go home to Leeds, Alabama, and explain to all his friends and buddies, oh, yeah, I eat with him, I shower with him, and I... They don't do that. And so Dixie said what the natural thing was. I don't want to do that. But to his credit, to Bobby Bregan's credit, once they met Jackie and once they saw him play, they both rescinded and said, well, you know, they didn't make a big deal out of it. They just said, we don't oppose that. He deserves a right to be here. So it's been blown up about the petitions and resentment on the Dodgers and the team being disrupted because of Jackie. It was just the opposite. He was such a great player. He started making the Dodgers winners. The Brooklyn fans embraced him like you wouldn't believe. And the New York sports writers, you want a group of critics that are really tough would be the New York sports writers. They saw Jackie play in 47 and voted him Rookie of the Year. So baseball accepted Jackie quickly and without a lot of fanfare. Yes, he got booed on the road. He couldn't stay with us in the hotels in those early years because they didn't accommodate black guests. So he would stay in a private home. Almost any city in the country that you could name would not permit black guests, fine hotels. And it took 7 years before the last hotel, St. Louis, Park Chase Hotel in St. Louis, to accept blacks. It took 7 years for society, but baseball accepted Jackie quickly. And so anybody says to me, baseball hadn't done enough for the minorities, I say, you weren't there.
Yeah.
Baseball did all of it, and society was the one that was dragging their feet.
Yeah, I do think sometimes people have the impression that the whole world was against Jackie Robinson, basically. But I've talked to, well, for example, Larry Brown, the basketball coach, was growing up in Brooklyn, and he told me once that as a kid, he liked Jackie Robinson so much he tried to imitate his walk. You know, he had that pigeon-toed walk. And so
well,
kids,
you forgot Jackie was black. You forgot his color. He was exciting in the game. He caused things to happen. He caused good players on defense to make bad throws. He just challenged everybody. And Jackie had a spirit about him that was amazing. And I don't think anybody could appreciate that he was a one-man operator. 10 years before Martin Luther King, Jackie Robinson was a civil rights movement all by himself. Well, I had to put Mr. Rickey in there because he's the one that coached Jackie, encouraged him, and admonished him or said to him, Jackie, you could whip anybody on the field. You're strong enough, but are you strong enough not to fight? Because if you fight, this experiment's done. So you got to take everything and not fight.
Yeah.
And Jackie could do that. It's amazing how he did it. But black leadership of that era was afraid of Jackie. He was too radical. And he didn't get much support from the black community. Hmm. The black fans turned out great for Jackie. But can you imagine this? Major League ballparks in some cities were segregated, and the black fans sat in the pavilion or the outfield stands, and white fans in the regular stands. You can't believe it happened in America.
I know.
But for the first two or three years, Cincinnati, St. Louis, a couple teams, they segregated the crowd. So what Jackie did was so historic in our country, and it was the right thing to do to break this horrible segregation barrier. And he's recognized as a great baseball player, but across society and in the black community, Jackie gets only a fraction recognition that he should.
I have to believe your childhood friendship with Johnny Wilson, who's black, must have made it just a no-brainer for you to embrace Jackie Robinson, that you weren't going to have any issues with race whatsoever because of how you grew up in Anderson?
Two things regarding that. I lived in a mixed neighborhood on the west side of Anderson. It was called Hazelwood in those days. And that was a black community mixed with a white community. And I knew a lot of outstanding families in that mixed area of Anderson, Indiana. But Jackie benefited from me in some way that I didn't even know, because I was colorblind with Jackie because of Johnny. And Johnny and I are still to this day very close friends, good buddies, play golf together occasionally. And Johnny is a great example of somebody who started below zero and made a quality life, a dignified teacher, coach that he was over the years. And when Jackie said to me one day, "You don't have a problem with this race thing, do you?" And I said, "Absolutely not." He said, "Well, tell me about that." I said, "I tell you two words, Johnny Wilson." That's the reason. He and my neighbors, black mixed neighborhood, quality people and good families. And so I had no problem with that. And then I said to Jackie something that I got a response out of him. I said, "Jackie, you got to realize something. Everybody with a white skin is not your enemy." Well, it stopped him in his tracks for a minute. And he looked at me and he said something very insightful, very, very thoughtful. He said, "Well, Carl, actually, bigots come in all colors." Now, we do not say that to ourselves often enough. It takes two to tango, right? I mean, you got to have responses the right way on both sides of a race issue. Well, Jackie had it. And it's one of the reasons that he eventually has been recognized as one of the great Americans.
Erskine meets someone else who helps break cultural barriers right under his own roof when One-on-One continues. Welcome back to One-on-One. I'm Mark Monteith. Carl Erskine made the move with the Dodgers to Los Angeles, but by then his arm, which had been injured in his Major League debut, was beginning to give out. He retired to Anderson, where he entered the insurance and banking industries and coached Anderson College's baseball team for 12 seasons. One of the highlights, however, were the lessons he learned from his son. How did the move to Los Angeles impact you? You had this great relationship with the fans in Brooklyn. Suddenly the Dodgers are moved to Los Angeles, the first team to go west beyond St. Louis. What impact did that have on you?
I can answer it two ways. Number one, it affected players in a different way. The older players, boys of summer, it'd be Hodges, Perillo, Jackie was already retired. And Campanella had been hurt in an auto accident that winter, so it eliminated both Jackie and Roy from going west with us. But Duke Snider, Don Newcomb, the nucleus of that Dodger team in Brooklyn, we'd all had our best years by the late 50s. When the team moved in 1958, it was an experience of like, how are we going to show our stuff when our best years are behind us. But then on our team in those days was a young pitcher named Don Drysdale, Sandy Koufax, Johnny Padres, and their careers had not really totally bloomed yet. And so they saw the move to the West Coast a lot different than some of us who had already had probably our best years behind us. So it made it tougher for us. So I finally retired after a couple of years in L.A. because of I was 32 years old and had a lot of arm trouble. The move was a strange experience. It was just amazing to leave Ebbets Field and leave the close confines of that ballpark and the rabid fans. And I pitched the opening game in Los Angeles, which we played the Giants opening day in 1958. And Walt Alston called on me to pitch the opener. Well, we had 80,000 people in the Coliseum, a football field.
Mm-hmm.
They skewed a diamond in there to have a place to play until they could build Dodger Stadium, which took about 3 years. So we played in this football stadium and a big crowd, and that 80,000 didn't make half the noise that 20,000 would make in Ebbets Field.
Yeah.
And so it was a curious day, and a lot of movie stars were in the stands that day. Bing Crosby, Danny Kaye, Lana Turner, I don't know, Jeff Chandler. There's just a whole array of movie stars there. Curious. This was a historic moment. But they didn't know us. They didn't know the Dodgers. They'd never seen Major League Baseball on the West Coast, or at least in L.A. So we beat the Giants in kind of a wild game, but I did get the first win. And so that was about my I made few contributions on the L.A. Dodgers, but that was the first one.
You made your last appearance on July 14th of 1959. I've read where you actually suffered an arm injury or shoulder injury as a rookie in your first start.
That was such a strange thing. I came up. I pitched year-round that year. I pitched. I won 21 games in the Class B, I think, counting the playoffs. Then I went to Cuba and pitched all winter and pitched a lot of innings down there. I think I won 9. I was 9-7 with kind of a mediocre team, really. But I pitched a lot of innings. I had a lot of decisions there. I came back to spring training, then went to Fort Worth, pitched and won 15 games. And then to the Dodgers, and I'd pitched constantly around the whole year. I didn't have any off season. Whether that contributed, I don't know. But I got a start against the Cubs, and it was a drizzly, rainy day. It drizzled the whole day, but we could still play. And we had a nice lead, 6-2 or something, in the seventh inning. And Bill Nicholson, big left-hand hitter, I struck him out on a high fastball. And when I did, I felt this sharp, hot pain in the back of my shoulder, and I'd pulled a muscle. I finished the game, got my first complete game win, and then 4 days later, we used to pitch every fourth day. They started me against the Phillies, and I could hardly warm up. My arm was killing me. But I'm a rookie. You don't say much. You don't go in the trainer's room either. So I started a ball game, and in the sixth inning, my arm was killing me so bad. I was kind of sick of my stomach. So I told our manager, Bert Schotten, who was an interim manager, replaced DeRocher, who'd gotten fired. But I told Mr. Schotten, I said, "Mr. Schotten, my arm is killing me. I did something to it in a Cub game, and I don't know if I can pitch anymore." And he looked at me with the biggest surprise on his face. He said, "Well, son, now look, you're pitching a shutout. Now you just go right ahead out there. You just keep doing what you're doing." Well, who would say any more than that as a rookie? So I went out and finished. I beat the Phillies 2-1. Another complete game. So 4 days later, they pitched me again. I pitched another complete game, went 8-1. I'm 5-0. And nobody in this world would believe that this kid had a sore arm. But I did a lot of damage that with those games. I finished the season 6-3 because I was really having struggles after that. And then and then go home. Nobody, there's no rehab. There was no knowledge of me being hurt. I went back to spring training in 49 and had a very difficult spring because I'd gone all winter. And that had partially healed and had scar tissue in there or whatever. So I just fought that the rest of my career. And fortunately, I was able to pitch another 11 seasons. But I never wanted to be known as a sore arm pitcher. I never wanted anybody to know I had any problems. So I was getting cortisone shots and whatever to keep going. And I had some decent years. But I always was so amazed that that could happen in my first start in the big leagues. But yeah. A lot of guys wash out quick after an injury. And I was able to hang around and win 122 ball games after that, so, or 120-some. But I've been pitching 5 World Series and just had great opportunities.
Another really an important aspect of your life that was made known by Roger Kahn in his book, Boys of Summer, is the fact that you have a son, Jimmy, with Down syndrome. You know, how does that impact your life? I mean, you know, from what everything I've heard, the kids with Down syndrome are so lovable and they really teach you a lot. I'm curious, though, when you first discovered that your son had Down syndrome, how that impacted you and then how you've grown from there.
You know, it is a long story. I had 3 healthy kids. The year I retired from baseball was 1960, and Betty was pregnant for her 4th child. Well, in April 1st of 1960, Jimmy was born. And we learned quickly, and I suspected something was not quite right with Jimmy. And when we got the diagnosis in, here's the medical term that we heard in 1960, and it's sort of reflective of how society understood or accepted somebody who was born with a birth defect like Jimmy. Mongoloid, mm-hmm. It was the word. You don't hear that word anymore because it's harsh and it's not... Down syndrome is the medical term now used, but that reflective word spoke volumes about the kind of life that Jimmy stepped into. Betty and I were shocked. We didn't understand it. Nobody else did, really, about the genes and all that came later. So Jimmy was going to be a different child, and Betty was the strongest one. She said to the doctors, who indicated the best thing to do, not to disrupt your family, is to find a good institution, and Jimmy would get good care. And Betty said, "Are you kidding? He goes home. I carried this little guy 9 months, and he's going home with us." And so I told my kids, who were 10, 8, and 3 at that time, that they got a special little brother who's going to need some help, and he might not do things as fast, and so we're going to have to give him a little help. Well, Mike, that must have been the best speech I ever made in my whole life, because my kids were tremendous with Jimmy. At a time when people look at a Downs person and they shied away, they said, "This person's different, look out, you might be something bad here." And kids would make fun of a Downs person. But my kids, no. They treated Jimmy like any little brother. They brought their friends home. My boys were athletes in football, baseball, basketball. My daughter was a cheerleader. They brought their friends home. Jimmy became just like the kid brother he was. And that was a great beginning. And then society, again, was pretty slow, like Jackie. You know, it's a parallel story, really, Jackie and Jimmy. Society didn't know what to do with Jackie in the beginning. They finally learned what was right. And lo and behold, here's Jimmy comes into my life. It's almost a parallel story. Society didn't know what to do with him either, and did a lot of bad things by rejecting both Jackie years ago and Jimmy and people like Jimmy. But the good news is that Jackie changed the world with how people see each other now and how society has become more inclusive and accepting. And in Jimmy's 50 years that he's lived since 1960, society has tremendously changed. And a Downs person now, visibly recognized, is embraced and understanding and accepted. And Jimmy has the chance to go to school. When he was 12, special ed came in. Special Olympics has been a great teacher for society on letting people have a chance and in watching people get the most out of what they've been given. There's some great lessons in Special Olympics. And then Jimmy has a job. He works at Applebee's restaurant. He's been there 11 and a half years. He does the tables before they open and does the condiments on the tables and wipes the tables and a few other jobs. And the manager said, "We couldn't run this place without Jimmy." Isn't that something? What a change from the day he was born till this morning when I took him to work at Applebee's, and he couldn't wait to get there. So that's two social changes in America that has overshadowed the wins, the World Series, the All-Star Games, the no-hitters, you name it. The two things that really happened in my career were Jackie and Jimmy.
One-on-One with Carl Erskine returns in a moment. Back on One-on-One, I'm Mark Monteith. Hey, thanks to Carl Erskine for telling his story. You know, this was one of the more difficult conversations to edit and fit into the time slot. He's got a lot to talk about, and we could have gone a lot longer than we did for this hour. In fact, we did. And to think we didn't even get to his harmonica playing. But you can check that out on YouTube. And you can check me out by email at mark@1070thefan.com. And don't forget, you can hear this and all other episodes of One-on-One on our website at 1070thefan.com. Scroll to the bottom of the homepage, click on the One-on-One window, and you'll have access to all the podcasts of this series. And I'll be back next week with yet another one, right here on 1070 The Fan.